You are now listening to Next on Scene with your host, Jackie Zuck. Showcasing tomorrow's scene today, for Startups to Celebrities, we are your source to find out what's next. Stay up to date at nextonscene.com or follow us on social media at Next on Scene on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And are you next? We want to hear from you. Stay tuned for who's next on scene. Welcome back to Next on Scene, everybody. Happy Tuesday. By the time you hear this, it will either be Tuesday evening or Wednesday. Welcome back to Next on Scene. It's your host, Jackie Zuck. Today, I am so excited to talk about a very important topic that more and more people need to bring upon their radar, all about mental illness awareness. So today I'm so excited to have the amazing Tracy Maxfield on the line from Canada. So who is Tracy? Tracy has a background with over 36 years of experience as a nurse, certified in gerontology and dementia care. So the reason that Tracy's become such a strong advocate for mental illness awareness is because she herself went through some serious chronic depression, went through bullying and things in the workplace that totally put her into a deep, dark place, and it was hard for her to come out of it. So I'm really inspired by her to write this whole amazing book called Escaping the Rabbit Hole, as it started originally as a blog. And I'm excited for her to share her story and bring more awareness to this very important topic. It's just truthfully not discussed enough in the public eye. So it's truly inspiring that Tracy, you know, in a very public setting it is to talk about very happy things, really brought light to things that people with mental illness really deal with on a regular basis, you know, whether it's every couple months, every couple weeks, you know, on a day-to-day thing they're struggling with right now. So I'm so excited to have Tracy on and really share her inspirations and insight and inspire you. So stay tuned for Tracy. I officially have the amazing Tracy Maxfield on the line. Hi, Tracy. How are you today?
I'm fine. I don't know if amazing is the word to describe me, but thank you. I'm good.
You are amazing, and you're truly inspiring, and I'm so honored to have you on today. I know I even said that before we started recording. So, I mean, you have so much to share. So let's first talk about your background. So you have 36 years of experience in nursing. What inspired you to become a nurse and to specialize? I didn't know how to pronounce it. Is it gerontology?
It's from the word geriatrics, care of older person, the aged person. And so dementia and gerontology were my specialities. What made me decide to become a nurse? Always wanted to. I can't describe it. From the age of two, I knew I wanted to be a nurse, and I used to bandage my teddies and my dolls.
That's adorable.
And used to try and figure out how to put on slings and things. And obviously, it was never perfect, because when I think about how I used to bandage, I probably cut off circulation and everything. But that's what I wanted to be. And that continued with me to today. Even when I went through periods where I stopped nursing for a couple of years, thinking maybe I'll do something else, it keeps drawing you back. And so I believe, and I think most nurses say that, it's something inside you.
Right, that just drives you.
That you know instinctively that is what you want to do. And so, yeah, from the age of two, I remember it well. They
Amazing.
Were all lined up. Yeah, I got a doctor's bag from my grandparents when I was about 4 years old as a Christmas present. So then I could take their temperature and a stethoscope to listen to their hearts. So
that's adorable.
That's how it began.
I love it. So obviously you've been in the caretaking industry for a long time. And then because obviously this whole podcast, I kind of do a little introduction before my guests come on about the subject of today. So, of course, you know, you've also been through clinical depression and you're also a mental illness advocate and speaking to so many different teenagers and children and doing amazing things to bring awareness to it. So can you tell us all about that first initial experience of when you actually realized that you were going through depression?
So I've had three episodes of really profound depression. The episode that I had in 2015 was absolutely nothing like my previous depressive episodes. But would you like me to describe the 2015 or the very first time I had depression?
What was the one that finally struck you to talk more about it and be more open, that you knew you had to do something about it?
The one I just had in 2015. Okay. I've always been very, very outspoken about it because I'm very, very conscious of the stigma. But it was the episode in 2015 that was the absolute worst episode ever. And in fact, I didn't even realize it was depression because of the physical symptoms that I also had at the same time. And it was the incident that kind of hurtled me, as I describe it in my book, down the rabbit hole, was on a Thursday in August 2015. I went home and I was just numb and was crying nonstop and just felt like life was over, and crawled into bed because no appetite, nothing. You just kind of want to forget about it. And then when I woke up the next morning, I literally could not move. I attempted to get out of bed and I couldn't. And I panicked thinking, oh my God, did I have a stroke or something during the night? What's happening? And when I finally mustered enough strength and energy to sit on the side of the bed, it felt like someone had come in the night and literally poured cement all over me. I felt like I was encased. And it was so heavy that when I stood up, I actually fell to my knees and I crawled. And I was crawling to go to the bathroom and then to go upstairs and get some water. The mood, meanwhile, was just, it was like I was in a fog. I knew that it was a Friday, and I knew what had happened the day before, but everything felt so oppressive and claustrophobic, and it was the sadness and the hopelessness, and there was no light, there was no hope. It just felt you were there, you were not really conscious of anything else going on. It meant nothing to you. And that was on the Friday. The Saturday, that continued again, and it progressed to the point where I just poured 44 acetaminophen Tylenol pills on the kitchen counter, poured myself a glass of water, made a pretty pattern, and picked up a pill because I was going to end my life. There was just nothing. Nothingness. It was just darkness and hopelessness, and there was no future, and the pain, the physical pain and the emotional pain. And people find it hard to understand that you can have mental pain, but it was like torture, and it's all negativity, and it's, you know, you're hopeless and pathetic and you deserve this and nothing, and you may as well just go. There's no point. There's no more life left for you. And there was a 10-second a voice, and it wasn't a voice that was in the room, and it wasn't even a voice in my head. It was kind of like something in my left ear, and kind of said no. And I put the pill down and I ran downstairs. I grabbed my purse and my flip-flops, and I just jumped into the car and I drove, and I just wanted to get away because I realized I was about to do something really, really bad to myself. And that kind of was the moment when I realized, okay, you've got to go and see your doctor. I realized with the suicide that there was a depression, but it was more than that. And I went to see my doctor on the Monday, and so began my journey.
Wow. So profound. And honestly, like, so what was that voice even like in your head? What is that experience even like?
It's not my voice. It's like a whisper that kind of told me, just no. And it was just that response. Like, I literally ran. And it sounds funny when I've just been saying I was encased in cement. But I ran, and I remember just, and I looked a mess. Like, as you can imagine, I had showered that day, but I was in shorts and a t-shirt. It was August, and my hair was a mess on my face. This is like now almost 48 hours of nonstop crying, and I just looked horrific. But I knew I had to just remove myself and just go. And so I ended up at Walmart because that was the only thing that was open on a Saturday night. And I just wandered. And it's like you're on automatic pilot. You're not conscious of anything. You're not conscious of people, the aisles where you're going up and down, what you're seeing. It's almost zombie-like. It's very difficult to explain. I liken it to, you know, when you're walking down a plane and you're wanting to make your way to the washroom or something, mm-hmm. and there's a little bit of turbulence, and so you're aware that you can't walk straight, and that you have to kind of make sure that you have the seat just to kind of support you, and you're conscious of all the people there, but it's the humdrum of different noises, because as you move from one seat to the next, you're just hearing snippets of conversations and, you know, things. And so it was that almost felt like automatic pilot walking down the plane, conscious of that there were people, but not, my brain wasn't registering that they were people talking because I wasn't a part of it. It was like I was on my own. And that's kind of what the experience of depression was like. And I still, when I have bad days, that's what it's like again. It's like you're existing, but you're not a part of anything. You're not, you don't even feel like you're a part of life. It's very, very strange. And yes, I mean, in my book, I describe it in great length, various episodes that I experienced and the pain and the anguish. And people have contacted me and said, I thought that was me.
And that's so powerful because people need to, like, when they feel relatable, it's like they know they're not alone. That's why it's so good that you shared your story.
Yes. I mean, never, like, literally when that happened, never in my wildest dreams did I think that a book was going to come out of it.
And, but you were meant to. Look, like, the journey that it led you to. It's, like, amazing. So I want to also talk about how, like, your book started as a blog. So can we talk about, like, how your book even came? Like, how did your blog even start?
So it was about a year into the – it was my doctor called it, I mean, I call it a massive nervous breakdown because that's what most people can relate to. My doctor called it an acute major depressive disorder. And when I started seeing the psychologist in the November of 2015, and it was a year later when I finally started, after we kind of titrated all the medications and I had therapy, and I was going to therapy every 2 weeks. And it was in December 2016 that he said, I kept going to him saying, it frustrates me so much. My friends, no one seems to understand what I'm going through. And these are healthcare professionals. And similarly, I would meet people when I would be going to get groceries or something. And the Brit in me, I would always make sure that I was nicely dressed and, you know, looking presentable. And when people would meet me, you know, you'd say the usual, you'd smile, but it's a dead smile because you don't smile from your eyes. And you say, I'm okay, everything's okay. And then they'd say, you know, what happened to you? Where have you been? And I would tell them, and you could see their body language and their eyes, right? The eyes never lie, and their mouth. And lots of them would just hurriedly make an excuse and leave, or others would come back with some of the most absurd comments, which actually showed either a level of ignorance and misinformation that they have about depression, or just their own selfishness and their inability to be compassionate. But when I started telling my doctor about, my psychologist about that and my frustration, and he said, have you ever thought about trying to write it down and showing it to your friends? And I said, no. And he goes, well, why didn't you start a blog? And so I thought about it, and he says, invite them to the blog, make it private to begin, invite them, tell them what it's about, and see if you're able to get them to have an understanding of what a day in your life is like. And so I ummed and ahed about it for a couple of weeks, and then I finally thought, you know what, let's do it. And it was hard because when I started putting the words down, and I've always written my entire life, I wrote poetry and everything and essays. It was easy because I'm used to that, but it was very raw. And I thought, if I'm going to do this, I want them to know 100% what it feels like. And I had journaled from the very beginning as well. And so I just opened myself up and told them what it was like. And within like a couple of hours of the blog being posted, so many of them contacted me and said, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry, didn't realize. And a couple of days later, posted again. And so the blog became like every 3 days or every week, posting everything from the moment I fell down the rabbit hole to the first suicide attempt, to the second, to how my days were. And I used illustrations as well. I found illustrations on Pinterest, and I put them on the blog because sometimes just a simple illustration of like a figure running away from a black cloud conveyed so much more than what words could to show this is my mood today. And I started to get doctors and psychologists and social workers who were reading it contacting me saying, you need to put this in a book. We didn't realize exactly what depression is like, and we also didn't realize that you have all the physical side effects as well. And it makes perfect sense now that you're actually putting it down and telling us. Now we understand what our patients or clients were going through, but we really didn't believe them or didn't identify that it was all part of depression at that time. And so every single time I blogged, it was, you need to put this in a book. And so finally, I think it was in the June after I'd started. So it was June 2017. Sorry, my vagueness.
No problem.
June, it was 6 months after I'd started the blog. In the June, I met someone on LinkedIn who lived in Montreal, and she had written many, many books and was also an editor and was promoting her new book. And I said, you know what? I've written a blog about my experience. People are telling me I need to make it into a book. If I give you access, could you tell me? And I said, just be really, really honest. If you don't think it's book worthy, tell me. I'll move on. And so she started reading it on the Friday morning. And like a couple of hours later, she sent me a message and said, I have you an editor in Toronto. You need to write the book. And here we are.
Amazing. It's so inspiring what you did, because a lot of people, like the first time that I ever connected with you, like it's so vulnerable to put yourself out there, you know, when you're going through something like that. And I respect you so much for doing that, because when you read a lot of blogs, it's a lot about fashion and a lot about like very, very constant upbeat things. And it's almost like you put a reality check on like, life is not always butterflies and roses. And like, this is like real life issues, you know? So
absolutely. And when we had decided that we should now transfer the blog and make it into a book, it was very much, I wanted it to be something for a person that was going through the same thing as me or had just gone through it. Someone living with depression to actually read it and know, okay, what I'm going through is actually normal, as horrible as it is. This is part of depression. And I also wanted to show them that it will get better and you will move to a better place. It will. There is light at the end of the tunnel, for want of a better word. I really wanted it to be a book of hope to show that I can do it. And I mean, I was on my own. I was living alone. I was divorced. I was living on my own. And so I had no choice. I mean, I had to get up. There was no one to force me or encourage me to get up. I had to get up to eat. I had to get up to take my medication. And I literally had to take control of my own life because there was no one else to even do that for me, to get me to the doctor or anything. And so I thought, you know what? If I can do it, then if people really want to get well, and that's the big thing, it's that if you read the book, you don't automatically become well. It's reading the book and understanding and going, oh, my God, that's me. I totally get it. And then, oh, look, she does get better. And I put my self-help tips in there, and this is what I tried. It may work for you. And if you want to get well, it empowers you to try and take back control of your life and start doing things that you can see, oh, I feel better today. Okay, there's hope. Because once you have a good day, you know you can. Because when you're in the midst of that darkness, you actually honestly believe you will never, ever feel joy or happiness again. Mm-hmm. And then when that happens, and it's not overwhelming indeed or anything, but it's a shift and you feel it. And you sit there and you go, oh, my goodness, I feel a little hopeful. And that kind of makes you proceed and keep moving forward. And I always keep telling people, I know it sounds cliche, but you've got to keep moving forward. Even on the bad days, you just got to say, okay, you know what? It's a bad day. I've had these before. I can get through it because I know there are good days because I've had them. And it's that. And it, I mean, it took me a long time. And I used to keep going to my psychologist and saying, can you give me a date? When is this going to pass? And he'd laugh and say, Tracy, that isn't how your brain works. You have to heal your brain. Like, you are healing and you've come so far and you just can't rush these things. It takes time because, I mean, in the book I say, I mean, for someone that was so hyper organized and could multitask and have this amazing memory and recall, all of a sudden, you know, it would take me 30 minutes to clean my teeth. It would take all day to put out the garbage. I would have to have lists. And so that's what kept me going. I would set up a routine for me and I would write it all down. And it was that, you know, ticking off. You did the laundry, you folded the clothes, you changed the bed. It was like, yay, I did it. Things that were seemingly so absolutely normal and just a part of life that you did automatically before I fell down the rabbit hole was now something that I was actually giving myself pats on the back for. And it seemed, but that's where you get. It's so horrible. I felt like I was in a rabbit hole. It was dark, it was cold, it was earthy. And it was just me and my comforter and a pillow. And then DBS, that is death by suicide, I envisioned him as a dark figure that was always there in the corner, waiting for me to show my ultimate weakness. And then he would take me and I would die by suicide. And so that was my life, and every day was a fight to live. It was a fight to live and a fight not to die. And so I thought, if people can read the book and see that, yes, I'm not pulling any punches, it's going to be horrible, and you're going to fight a battle, but you will get out of it because I did, then my book worked. That was what I wanted my book to do, was to help those with depression and then also be helpful for those caring for someone with depression or knows someone with depression, that they wouldn't be so impatient and hard on them and understand when they say, I really can't get out of bed right now, not come back and say, oh, you're just milking this, you're just lazy. Well, come on, for goodness sake, what's wrong with you? There truly is a reason why they can't get out of bed, and you really have to be more supportive. And so, yes, that became my ultimate hope as the book started to fall into place.
Amazing. Well, obviously, you have a great story to tell, and you're doing a lot of, like, you know, talking to young kids and teenagers and stuff like that. I definitely want to get more into it. But even one step further, you know, obviously, you said your first episode was 2015. So can you talk about things that triggered, you know, like, because obviously you went so long without it. So what was something that totally kind of put it over the edge for you?
Well, no, I had chronic depression or genetic depression. So my very first depressive episode was in my mid-20s. And at that time, it was related. I had already moved from the UK to Canada. I'd moved in 1987. I was nursing again. I was newly married. And I had had a very, very horrible childhood. Lots and lots of child abuse. It was an incident from my past with my parents, who I've not spoken to actually since that event, that led to my first depressive episode. And with therapy and medication, I was actually able to come off the medication after a year, and kind of life went on. And then about 15 years later, there were a number of stressors in my life again, and I had another episode. Went to therapy, started an antidepressant, and I saw a psychiatrist. And at the time when he was taking my history, he said, I think you have a genetic depression based on your family history. All the females on my father's side of the family had experienced depression. And so he said, I think that you need to stay on a low dose of antidepressants and be very cognizant of how you respond to stresses and things, because the way it usually goes is once you've had one episode, every 10 to 15 years, you can have another episode. And so I thought, okay, on antidepressants, going through life, I certainly was, you know, I didn't have a date marked on my calendar. This is going to be
right, of course. Yeah.
But around 2012, things started to fall apart in my life. My ex, who was still my husband at that time, we couldn't have children, but we had dogs, and they were our kids, per se. And one of our dogs became very, very sick and died within 4 days. It was so sudden. Oh. And at that point, I felt, and I say in my book, it was like a light switch went off in my brain. It was like a switch just died. And it was very, very odd. I felt very numb, and I couldn't grieve with my husband over the dog. I grieved silently. That kind of started the wheels in motion. If 3 months later we separated, I mean, everyone was like, what? I thought, oh no, we get back together, it's just the stage I'm going through. But we separated. The next thing, he bought me out of the house. I ended up buying my own place, moved out, and that was it. Divorced a year later. I was at that time working in a new position at the hospital, a very, very stressful position. And that's when I started to encounter my workplace bullying. My superior was a bully, so harassment, threats, intimidation. It had been going on even before the separation, but hadn't really thought about it too much, just kind of, you know, in the back of your mind, you think, oh, she's just a bitch kind of thing. And I really loved my work, and I threw myself into my work. But it seemed after I'd moved out on my own, things just intensified. And in the December of 2014, I challenged her over something that was very, very serious regarding a patient. She was in the wrong. She knew it. And because of that, she was exposed, and that kind of signed my fate. From that point on, it was whatever she could do to undermine me, threaten me, mar my reputation. And so it was all this culmination I can see now. It was separation. It was the divorce. It was moving out on my own. It was the death of my dog. It was the workplace stressors, which were then intensified by the bullying took on a whole new realm. And I was getting burnt out because of the stress at work. I had 2 bouts of back-to-back pneumonia, had never been sick before ever. And so you could kind of see the writing was on the wall, but even then I still go into work, almost working 12-hour days. And it just culminated with a series of meetings where I was ostracized. I was removed from emails. No one was allowed to connect with me. I was moved to an office. No windows were about. And it was that meeting in the August that was just so horrible. It was just 1.5 hours of stress and false accusations and allegations and lies and personal stuff. And it was just horrible. And it just broke me.
When you were just trying to clear the air about a situation, it like blew up into something beyond, it seems.
You know, what had happened was that because of that incident that had happened in the December, the superior wanted revenge, ultimately, because she had done something which was illegal and unethical, and I had caught her at it and exposed her. And she wanted to get back at me. There's no other way for it. And so it was just a series of things that she did to make me feel very insecure and unwelcome in my role, to the point where I was moved from the hospital to another place with people that I did not know. I was cut off email, so I could not even have access to my email. No one was allowed to communicate with me. It was, in Britain, it's called sent to Coventry.
That's crazy.
And so I was put in an office with 4 walls and a door away from everybody. I had no communication with anyone, and I was told to do a project it was a special assignment to do a project. And the project would take 6 to 8 weeks, and then I could return to my position. But I knew it wasn't. I knew that there was a plan. And me being me, I can advocate for myself very well. I challenged it, and I took it higher. And of course, that didn't help, because then the decision was that she knew she had to get that. Either I did it her way, or else I go. And it just, as I said, it was just horrible. Oh my goodness, And so that meeting was actually for me to return to my position, because the upper management had said what had happened was unacceptable and it should never have happened. And I was to return immediately to my prior role, except my superior decided she was not going to let that happen nicely. And it just became... it was like the Spanish Inquisition. I had 2 union representatives with me, and even they walked out and said, in all their years of sitting in on these meetings, they had never, ever experienced anything like that. It was like she had a vendetta, and she just went for my jugular. And when you're being told that every single person you work with hates you, that she had personally gone and spoken to them all, and they all said they never wanted me to see me again. It was all lies. We were able to prove that was all lies. But to actually hear that coming from somebody, that's
awful.
Rips at you.
Yeah, that's awful.
Because, I loved my job. I was so good at it. I had a great team, and yet she had systematically ostracized me from everyone. That was just the straw that broke the camel's back. After everything else that had been happening and all the stresses and the being unwell, and my psychologist and my doctor kind of looked at me and said, it was inevitable. That was it. And yes, break me, she did. Absolutely.
But you know what, Tracy? You got out of it. You got out of it. You're in a much better place now. You're doing amazing stuff. So, and it's great that you can share that. Like, amazing.
And exactly. And that's why I wanted to be 100% raw and honest and transparent for people to understand that, yeah, I went to hell. I really did. But there is a better place. My life is so completely different. I'm different. It does change you. And every person who's been through bullying or a depression, say it changes them. It makes them look at themselves and look at life. And you come away with a completely different perspective and different values of what is truly important to you and who you actually want in your life as you embark on a new journey.
Right. So true. Wow. I'm like blown away by all of your inspiration. The fact that you can be so vulnerable and share all of these like inspiring things is very powerful. So thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you. Even when the book was released, there was that inner conflict for a day or so thinking, oh my goodness, did you make the right decision? And then when teenagers started reading my book and started to identify, because my book has lots of illustrations in it as well. My editor is also an artist. And so she was able to draw lots of illustrations that were similar to what I had used in my blog to kind of convey how I felt on certain days and on certain events. And they were able to identify so much with that that I realized that, yes, in order for people to truly understand and to trust you and to know that what you're saying is true and real, you have to be transparent and honest. You have to, especially with kids. Kids know if you're not.
It's true.
They can sense it. And so, you know, every single word in there is 100% me and what happened and what I felt. And it's the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Right.
100, yes.
No,
and, you know.
You're absolutely right. Just listening. No, you're good.
So that's the only way, I think, is by really bearing your soul and putting it out there, but also showing them that, you know, there are the good days as well. It can't all be bad. And that's what I wanted the book. The book evolves. And as people go through each chapter, and there's journal entries in there as well, so they can see on certain days just how I really felt. And, I mean, swear words and all. I mean, and it shows them that, you know, when you go through this and you get to the other side, that life is still not a bed of roses because it's life.
Right.
Right? Just because you've gone through this, don't think that you're going to be all sugar sprinkles and cotton candy and life is amazing, hallelujah and everything. It isn't, because you're still going to go through stresses in life, which is a normal part of life, and you're still going to have crummy days, but you can still work your way through them, because they tend to be a little bit more heightened when you have a depression, certainly, but you understand them not as you're falling back down your rabbit hole or wherever you think you liken your depression to. Some people think of it as they're in a well. One lady I spoke to thought that she was in a cornfield and she could see the light, but she couldn't get out to an open area. And so it was just for people to understand that you recognize today is just a bad day. It's just one of those gray, gross days. But it doesn't mean that I've relapsed and I've gone back down the rabbit hole. And so tomorrow is going to be better. And it's that. And it was, I express gratitude in my journal. I used to start expressing gratitude and to look for things that gave me joy. Oh, I looked at and thought, wow, this is wonderful. And it was simple things, right? It was a flower. I went out after a rainstorm and there was a cobweb and there were raindrops and the light shone through it. And I thought, wow, that's nature, right? That's beautiful. And so you become very mindful. You learn to live in the moment and you appreciate the little things. and I wanted to put that down in my expressions of gratitude in my journal and throughout the book for people to see. It's not I bought myself a new pair of shoes or I just went and had a steak dinner. It's the little things. It's the I walked into Starbucks and they gave me a free drink. And it was
right.
Thank you. I went outside and I saw the first flower of spring and it was just absolutely beautiful amongst all the snow and all the brown. And it's those little things. And as you start learning to be more mindful and living in that moment, then you start appreciating everything that goes on around you and it becomes more natural. At the beginning, it was like, okay, what have I got to be grateful for today to put in my journal? And then it was just, it became normal. It was just a natural part of, even today, I still journal. And at the end of the day, I'm like, okay, what was I grateful for today? And it's lots of things keep going back to nature or to people. You know, someone paid me a compliment or I got the nicest smile back. I always smile at people. And people don't like making eye contact and smiling. I noticed that. Right? They don't. Everyone is so focused on their device or on going from A to B. And if I do catch someone's eye and smile and say hello, lots of people will smile back. Others will look quite taken aback and walk away. And others look at you and then have a moment's hesitation and then smile back and say, thank you.
Yeah.
That to me is gratitude, because it's like, you know, I smiled at 10 strangers and 3 of them responded back and one person actually said, thank you, you made my day. And that's gratitude. It's not the materialistic things, it's the little things. And I think that's what changed my whole value system and my perspective as I moved forward to where I am today on this journey, because selling my home, giving away my possessions to charity and saying, I'm using my money and I'm going to go and try and help these kids and let's get the word out about mental illness in children and teenagers and let's try and get some change going in policies and some education. If you'd have asked me 10 years ago, 5 years ago, if you'd even asked me a year ago, when the book was released, I would be talking to you today. I would have said, nah, I can't see this happening. But things, it just evolved. Mm-hmm. And you just make decisions. You hear whispers, and it's the right thing. And you start on that path, and then things start unfolding for you. So you know, okay, I can keep going on this path. And it feels right. It feels the right thing to do. I've never doubted it. I've had days where I've had so many doors slammed in my face, I think, is it worth it? And then something will happen. I'll have a message from someone saying, oh my goodness, I just read your book, thank you.
And that, like, that's everything. It's so true. It's like you're talking about all the little things. I'm like such a big advocate for gratitude journaling. I do it too, so I love that you do that. That's awesome.
And I encourage people in my book to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, even, you know, and I know boys don't like expressing gratitude, but I've spoken to so many teenagers and I said, well, don't, you know, just maybe write it on post-it notes or just, you know, if there's a real inspiring quote that really moves you, that, you know, a professional sports star or somebody said, then write it down and put it somewhere that you can look at it. And in your mind, you know, every night, read the quote and then think to yourself, what was good that happened today? And then they would come up with things, right? And their gratitude may be different to what a girl or a woman's gratitude is, because, you know, different things mean different. Little things mean, let's try again. You may have to edit that part.
Oh, that's okay. No worries. Keep going. I'm good.
We're all unique individuals, right? Mm-hmm. And so whereas I may look at a flower and it means something to me, another person may look at a cat and, you know, playing and say, oh my goodness, that just made my day. And for a teenage boy, it may be that the cutest girl in school smiled at him, right? Or he got an A, or the teacher said, keep up the good work, or the coach said, I can see you're improving. That's expressing gratitude to them, and that's the little things. It's the little things that make you feel good and make you feel like your heart and soul are starting to, I liken everything to a puzzle, are starting to come back together again. The puzzle is, the brain is a puzzle, and your heart and soul were fragmented by, you know, your depression or whatever you're going through, but they're slowly starting to heal again by all this positivity and the nice things that have made you feel good that day.
Right.
If that makes sense.
A lot of sense.
Well, and so it's, you know, and I think that's how you have to go through, when you've gone through something like this, that's how you continue to go through life, because you've been in the hole as bad as it can be, and you want to keep moving forward purposefully.
So true. Intentions are so important. And the days, just like, I like how you brought up the analogy earlier too about talking about when, you know, you knock on so many doors and you're like, is this worth it? Is this worth it? And then you have like one breakthrough moment. It's like, you have to keep doing it. You know, like there's a reason that you're put on this journey, and like, you have to explore it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's why I do. And it's just, it's very strange because yes, it's like, oh, I can't do this anymore. And then out of the blue, you know, it'll be something.
So true.
And you'll go, okie dokie. Then that was my whisper. Let's keep going. And yes, it is. And as I said, I mean, with the podcast, when you air it tomorrow, all my hope is that somebody who listens to it takes away something which can help them in the future. So it may be that someone with depression isn't listening to it, but maybe someone who knows a friend or a family member, or even in the future meets someone and they say, oh gosh, I've gone through this depression, I feel terrible. And they've learned something from our conversation today that they can then take and help that person, then my work is done.
It's, right.
I mean, it's trying to help support and make a difference and help that person feel like, okay, you know, we've got you. You will get through this. We're there for you. You're not alone. I think that's the big thing, right? At the end of the day, you are not alone. Please do not ever think that you were going through this journey on your own. You are not. I've been there. So many of us have been there. And we're all with you. We're all in this together. I keep saying this. We're all in this together.
Right. It's keep so going. True. And that's why it's so important to, like, I just give you so much credit. We talked about this even earlier, but it's like you just keep showing up. Like, you keep showing up. You keep sharing your story. And that's how the message gets across, when you just keep showing up, you know?
You have to, because mm-hmm. you truly do not know who is listening, and you do not know what is going on in people's lives, as I said. I mean, depression, they call it the invisible illness, but so many mental illnesses are invisible. And people with panic disorder and anxiety, I mean, social anxiety disorder and eating disorders. I mean, the list goes on and on. The stigma is because you're not out there with it visible on you. And we learn to conceal it so very well, to be appropriate,
right?
Because of the stigma. And it's, you know, you have the person with the broken leg gets the sympathy, and it's like, hello, you know, but again, it's, you have to keep sharing the stories and giving other people courage, not only to keep moving forward, but also maybe to go and talk to friends and family about what they're going through and help support each other and educate each other. I mean, I'm a great believer in the more people know, the better informed they can, not only to help each other and themselves, but to advocate for something.
Right.
Like, okay, we know the facts now. You're absolutely right. then I'm better prepared now to go to school and say to them, you need to have an anti-bullying policy, or you need to help these kids and talk to them more about mental health and how to cope with stress, things like that. It's I mean, my philosophy and on my business card, it's the three E's. It's engage, educate, empower.
Love it. Love it. It's so true, though. Those are three key things when it comes to sharing awareness.
Absolutely. And so that's my philosophy and my mantra. And that's what I'll keep doing until
the end of time.
I take my last breath or someone comes up and says, be gone with you.
I think you're meant to continue to share it and grow. It seems like you already are pretty international on this level, Tracy, right?
Well, not as much as I would like to be, but certainly it's, again, you're fighting something that people know about, but people are not comfortable talking about.
It's true.
Because we have centuries of stigma, and the social media makes it worse, right? Every time there's a shooting or an incident, the first thing they assume is, oh, the person has to be crazy or has a mental illness. Not necessarily. How about actually looking into some of the facts first before you even make that declaration? Because again, then as soon as those words are out there on social media, everyone who was just about to confide in someone about their mental illness goes, maybe not today. And, you know, that's not appropriate, and that's not fair, because that's not helping them heal. And so I'm kind of the in-your-face girl I'm the Brit in the high heels that's going, okay, let me tell you something.
Right.
And, you
let's bring this uncomfortable conversation to life. Like, people need to get out of their comfort and really start helping themselves by helping each other, right? So
absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I put a post out there a couple of days ago, and I said, I defy anyone out there to contact me and say that they have never, ever met someone, known of someone, or experienced mental illness. And I said, send me a comment and tell me that in your entire life, you have never, ever had to deal with that. And I did not get one response.
Crazy.
So we know, I mean, one in four adults have a mental illness.
Totally.
One in five children and teenagers have a mental illness. I mean, we know. You know somebody, a family member, a friend, a neighbor, someone in your sports team. Yes, it's out there, and we've really got to bring it up front and personal and just talk about it, because it's nothing to be ashamed of. I mean, it is, our brains are part of us. Mental health is a normal part of life. So something happened with all the stresses and things, and now you're dealing with an anxiety or an obsessive compulsive or a depression. Guess what? You can put this into remission with work support, and you can learn to live with it and have an awesome life. Your illness does not define you. I think this is what's really important for people to understand. You were still Joe, you were still Sue, you were still Carol, who happens to have an anxiety disorder, but also is brilliant at playing the piano and does all this charitable work. And there's so many other wonderful things that makes you that person. It's just a small part of you. It really is.
Right.
And we shouldn't be allowing people to be defined by their illness. Mm-hmm. And people went through that decades ago when the AIDS stigma came around. And we've moved, I mean, it's still there, but we've moved forward a lot since then. We need to do that with mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I'm going to give it my best shot.
Yeah, well, I think you're doing great. I love the message that you just said about how your mental illness does not define you. It doesn't. It's so true. It's just a part of you, you know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all have something. We don't have perfect bodies, right? We all have something. Moles, speckles, a wart, an ingrown toenail, that doesn't define you. So, but it's still a part of you, and right. you go on with life with it. So again, we've got to start getting, especially our kids, to understand it does not define who you are. It is just a part of you, and you can go and have a wonderful life. We'll help you. I mean, you develop strategies, coping strategies, and, you know, self-awareness and counseling and support systems, and you may need medication. And again, I mean, usually with kids and teenagers, it's not something that they have to do for the rest of their lives. And I think that's what people need to be aware of. Where, you know, if you need medication at the beginning to help you with something, it does not mean you have it for the rest of your life. And it's just that there's so much misinformation out there that really, by correcting that, will help create more awareness and will help, I think, reduce the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
The more we know.
No, so inspiring, Tracy. So, you're doing amazing stuff. How can people, one, get the book and reach out to you and follow you on social media? Tell us.
So, okay, so the book is available on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble. But if you actually just go to my website, www.tracymaxfield.com, information about the book is there, all the links to my different social media. You'll see what I'm doing. There's also loads of articles on mental illness and bullying, especially in teenagers. There's information about dementia, mental illness, and adult suicide. So it's kind of like one-stop shopping. There's also every interview I've done, podcast, radios, TV, upcoming events, that's all there. So if they just click in, even if they just put in my name, so much will come up. I'm amazed at what comes up on social media now. And go to my website, and there's resources there, my self-help tips, the illustrations from the book, suicide hotlines. Every single hotline from around the world is listed. And so hopefully they'll find something that's very helpful for them.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on today again. Seriously, what an inspiring story you have, and to come out and share it is so powerful. So I'm really honored to help showcase you today. It was such an honor.
Thank you. I'm so humbled and honored that you asked me onto your podcast, and I hope that it'll help maybe more than one person.
Me too. Me too. So anybody, seriously, if you are listening and know somebody who's going through this, or if you're going through this yourself, definitely check out Tracy's website, her latest book. Reach out to her. She's awesome, as you can tell, and really open to response. So thank you
Absolutely.
Again so much, Tracy, for joining us. Thank you, everyone, so much for tuning in to Next on Scene. I'm sure you're inspired, as I totally am. And stay tuned for who's next on scene. Thanks so much for tuning in to Next on Scene with your host, Jackie Zuck. Showcasing tomorrow's scene today, for startups to celebrities, we are your source to find out what's next. Are you next? We want to hear from you. Get in touch with us today at nextonscene.com or get social with us at Next on Scene on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And are you next? We want to hear from you. Stay tuned for who's next on scene.